So this is work in cooperation with a number of people. André van der Bouwede, who is in the audience here. Also on the numerical side, Willy Govaerts and his students in Ghent, Jorge Galan and an entire group of people in Seville. And also at Caltech, Herb Keller and Randy Passenroth. On the aerospace side, Don Diekman, also from Los Angeles. Numerical side, Yuri Kuznetsov in Utrecht. And recently, I also got some graduate students who were very interested in this. And I think it's sort of a topic that appeals to people and that graduate students tend to find fun. So the circular restricted free-body problem models, as most people know, the motion of a satellite in the presence of a two-body system, for example, the Earth and the Moon. And well, I guess we know that the Moon goes around the Earth sort of in a circular motion. And you want to find out what the motion is of a small mass body, a satellite, in this system. So if you put it into a rotating coordinate system, that being the Earth and the Moon, a rotating coordinate system, so that the position of the Earth and the Moon would be in a fixed place, and you normalize things, then you get the very well-known equations that are shown here. Was there a pointer, or was that Phil's personal perspective? Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So the equations then are in six-dimensional phase space, x, y, and z coordinate, and it's a conservative system. There's one parameter only in there, and that is this parameter mu. So the x, y, and z are the positions of the spacecraft, basically. And actually, Michael Delnitz, of course, yesterday already referred to this problem also. So mu is the mass ratio of the bodies, like the Earth and the Moon. To be precise, it is the ratio of the smaller mass divided by the sum of the two masses. Okay? And so, typically, as you can imagine, the interest is in small values of mu. So, for example, for the Earth-Moon system, mu is about 1%, and for the Sun-Earth system, it's about, I think, 10 to the power minus 6, if I remember correctly. But today also I will look at larger values, okay, which are not quite relevant in our solar system, but nevertheless very interesting, I think, to investigate, maybe for binary stars or something else. So I think this is a problem that sort of speaks to the mind of people, because if you stand outside on a clear Toronto night and you look at the sky, everybody, I think, starts wondering about these things, right? So. And many, many people have, of course, worked on this problem. And so the last I want to do today is to to pretend that I'm really doing something totally new. I think I'm having fun discovering things that many of which you can find in the literature, going back many, many years in some cases. Okay, so in any case, what is sort of easy nowadays for many people is to compute families of periodic orbits, for example, that emanate from the libration points. Now, what's a libration point? Yes, Michael has already explained it, so I can save a little bit of time. So this system of equations has four equilibria, right? Once you put it into a rotating coordinate system. And one of those is sort of obvious. That is the one that is sort of between the Earth and the Moon, but a bit closer to the Moon, where the gravitational pull sort of cancels each other. Okay? But as Michael mentioned yesterday, there are actually four other ones, and we will see those. And that seems a bit odd, maybe, okay, but remember that the Earth and the Moon are not standing still. They really do go around. Okay, so so the actual libration points really correspond to periodic orbits in the inertial coordinate system. So this has been done a long, long time ago, analytically and also numerically. And actually, it's surprising to see what people did on very primitive computers many, many years ago, or even without computers, by doing hand calculations. I'm really amazed when I find out some new references going back a long, long time. Another thing is, of course, to look at secondary and tertiary, etc., bifurcating families. And of course, there's also tori and so on, etc. in here. So this has an incredibly rich solution structure, and one has to focus on certain aspects in order to actually be able to terminate the work. And in fact, I think it's the sort of work you might get stuck in and work on for the rest of your life. And I think quite a few people have really spent most of their lives working on this sort of problem, or this problem. But I think a bit of a challenge still is, even though there's a lot of information available, is to classify some of the most basic families for our values of mu. And that is sort of something I set out to do. So prior numerical work, maybe I should have mentioned Kepler instead of Francoulet, okay, but to be even safer. So there's many, many, many people. And as a matter of fact, I brought a paper that I could put down somewhere here, a few copies of a paper that has a lot of references and also a lot of color pictures, some of which I will show to you later on. So anybody interested can pick up a copy while they last. So also amazing work on certain aspects of what I want to talk about today were done back in the 60s by Jacques Honrard from Liège in Belgium. Actually going on, there are two books by Michel Hainaut on the restricted free body problems on periodic orbits, restricting actually to the planar orbits. Okay? And yet there's an enormous wealth. Today I will, in the work we're trying to do, we concentrate a bit more on three-dimensional orbits. Okay? But and also there's a lot of work, and book in fact again, on planar families of planar periodic solutions in the restricted free body problem by Alexander Bruno from Moscow. Who would be very, very happy to explain a lot of detail to you on the problem. Of course, there's a lot of work on the Barcelona group, and of course, people at JPL, I should mention also. So there's a huge number. And of course, also very interesting new approaches were shown to us yesterday by Michael Delnitz, Oliver Junge, and co-workers in Paderborn, Germany. So it's a conservative system, so there is an integral of motion, sort of an energy, you know, involving squares of velocities, some sort of potential, and of course that parameter mu, the mass ratio, is in there, and that leads to some minor subtleties. But in any case, I don't want to dwell on any numerical aspects here. What we can use is continuation software for boundary value problems. So rather than using shooting techniques, we use boundary value techniques. And the way to do that is first to write the system really as a six-dimensional system in six-dimensional phase space. Another thing you do is to scale time. So looking for periodic solutions now just is looking for one periodic solution, and the actual period then appears like an explicit parameter in the equations. So now it becomes like a boundary value problem. So we can use boundary value software. Since it's autonomous, you need a phase condition of some sort. And the whole objective is to do continuation once you have a periodic orbit to follow it. And so the software we use is, I guess, Auto, but there's a whole range of software. I guess I should have mentioned DS2, of course, in this context, right? But I guess this sequence has in common the fact that they are based on orthogonal collocation as discretization. So they, and I guess DS2 is a sort of an independent, brilliant piece of work, independent of this to some extent, right? But so. Exactly. Okay. So, yeah. So that is what should be meant. There's a little bit of a subtlety in here because even if the parameter mu is fixed, this being a conservative system, you already get families of periodic solutions. Many, many, too many. Okay. You can spend your whole life and more trying to find those. So numerically, however, if you would discretize, you would get a non-square system. Okay. So this leads to a minor subtlety in a way, and a way you can very, very easily take care of that. And I guess a lot of people haven't realized that, is that you introduce an artificial parameter in here, a lambda here, and some perturbation term, which if you take that to be the gradient of the conserved quantity, so that is the Jacobian constant, then suddenly you get a problem that is properly posed. And once you solve it, you not only solve for the periodic orbit and for the period capital T, but you also solve for lambda. And upon solution up to numerical precision, lambda will be zero. Okay, so this is like an unfolding parameter that embeds your problem in a larger space. And as a matter of fact, for those people that do numerical continuation, numerical continuation of singularities, this is the whole business of continuation. You embed your problem into a larger space rather than making it smaller in order to make a computation regular. So this is a bit of a subtlety, but on the other hand, it's a trivial change, and it allows you to use standard bifurcation software and techniques to study conservative systems. And it's not absolutely not restricted to the case of only one conserved quantity. So in fact, the theory was done much by André van der Bouwheide, and also there's a recent thesis by Muñoz-Almaraz in Seville, Javier Muñoz-Almaraz, and the whole group of Jorge Galán, Emilio Freire, So Andre and I have made frequent trips to Barcelona. Very hard work, of course. So not Barcelona, to Sevilla. Very hard work there. Also, there is a popular version with a lot of pictures and sort of an intuitive description. That is of which I brought a few copies, this paper here, that people that are interested could pick up, that might be interested to hand to students, for example, to show that there are really interesting problems around it. Okay. Also, you can download some of these things. Whoops. That was very slow. Now, because these pictures are a bit too big in size, it may disappear because I... Let me go back. One. I have to push the right button. So, up. Try again. So that is a bifurcation diagram that you can easily compute. Okay, so using these bifurcation software, and this is like this is sort of complete if you look at same period bifurcations where that's this is not an orbit, that's a family. Okay, it's a bifurcation diagram. It's a bifurcation point, and at this point, if you look at this family and that family, at this point they really got the same orbit and the same period. So I'm not including subharmonic bifurcations, etc., or torus bifurcations. So this is really a skeleton. There's a lot more around it. Okay? So this, we call these elemental orbits, those that come from the libration point. That's a libration point. Even though this is a bifurcation diagram, nevertheless, it looks a bit like a phase diagram with the moon and the Earth and the moon in there and the libration point. That is the libration point closest to the moon. And what you notice is there are actually two families coming out of here, and that has been known for a very, very long time. One are the planar Lyapunov orbits, and the other one are called the vertical orbits. And here is another equilibrium, very interesting one. And you notice that at least when mu is small, like in this case, there are actually three families coming out of here. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on that I won't have the time to talk about today. And actually, very, very impressively, Jacques Honorat did a lot of analysis on it already in the 1960s, okay, on IBM computers with cards and very little memory. And I was really impressed when I saw what he did a very long time ago. But I can only, in the 10 minutes that I have, I think, show you zero in on some minor details. But just to give you some idea of how these orbits look like, I will concentrate on L1, the libration point close to the moon, between the Earth and the moon. And so here is where the two families are coming off, the planar Lyapunov ones and the vertical orbit. And I'll show you the Lyapunov orbits, the vertical orbits. There's an interconnecting family, which we have called the axial orbit. Also, the existence of that was known. Okay? I think most, if you look at the literature, probably, not totally certain, though, you probably might find each one of these families, but scattered in over a long period of time in a lot of journals. And also, I want to show you these are known, this family is known as the halo family. Now, these pictures are very big, so it takes a bit of time for them. Yes, the Jacobi constant is changing, but of course, it is not an explicit parameter in the continuation scheme. Okay? So, yeah. Correct. So here what you see are the Lyapunov orbits, the moon and the Earth. This is the libration point L1. You probably can't see it. There's a small orbit of a different color. Is this blue? I'm colorblind. Okay, it is blue. And there's two that are blue then, and those are actually bifurcation orbits. So orbits where another family having the same period at a bifurcation point bifurcates. Okay? And they get very big, and ultimately, as you can see, they become collision orbits. Okay. I'm going to go right through the Earth. Why not? Okay, but I guess the Earth is a bit off scale here. All right. So those are the Lyapunov orbits. These are planar, as you can see. Okay, they lie actually in the orbital plane. These are the vertical orbits. Here is the libration point L2. L1 you can't actually see there, but that is the Moon, and they start off as small vertical oscillations. That's why they're called the vertical orbits. But this family actually sort of gets bigger and bigger, as you can see, and finally it attaches to a circular family, a family that goes around the Earth, and in a reverse period doubling bifurcation. So the vertical orbit. Then this is the one that's an interconnection. This is a planar orbit. That's one of the Lyapunov orbits that I colored in my picture. It's a bifurcation orbit. And then there's sort of a family in between, which, of course, goes on. There's another part also. And that connects to one of those vertical orbits. You see, the vertical orbits start in a linearized model as a perfectly vertical oscillation, but then they start looking like eights, yeah, like figure eight. Nothing to do with the famous figure eight orbit of Chansonnet and Montgomery, by the way. So this is another family, axial orbits. So here are the halo orbits. There's sort of interesting transition going on, which you can't see behind there. Okay, because the halo orbits, if you remember the bifurcation diagram, also bifurcate from the planar Lyapunov orbits. So they start plane and they sort of start tilting, and at some point they become bigger and bigger, and they finally also they become a circular orbit, one that encompasses both the Earth and the Moon. So they connect to a circular family, one of the families that, of course, has been very well studied. What I'd like to do is also look at the same family a little bit from the inside. So imagine you're on the Earth or somewhere. Well, here is the Earth, and you're looking at the moon is there, that is the libration point L1. So they start at the planar orbit, which you cannot quite see here, they start tilting and tilting, and now, as you can imagine, if you're standing on the Earth and you're looking at the moon, these sort of would form a halo around the moon, and this is why they're known as halo orbits. Anyway, that was my very quick introduction to some pictures of these things. And what are halo orbits good for? Well, right now the Genesis mission is in a halo orbit. As of December 3, it was here, and I think, I believe already in 2004. Is Michael here? Is it 2004 it will land in Utah? It's already on the way back, but I mean, I downloaded it just a week ago, and it showed on December 3 it was here. Okay, how do you know? Yeah, okay, so I'm not totally sure. I thought it was in 2004 it was supposed to come back, but maybe I'm... Okay, so these things are actually of interest. Now, what we're trying to do is classify the families that I showed you in the bifurcation diagram, which was for the case like, not actually not totally true, but very, very similar to the one for the Earth-Moon system, to classify that for all possible mass ratios. And there's very interesting transitions that take place. And so one thing that you want to do is to actually follow these bifurcation points that I showed you in the bifurcation diagram. This has been known for a long time. If you look at sort of a general system F of some unknown X, lambda is zero, F is a mapping from Rn plus 1 into Rn, then at the bifurcation point, what you need is that the transpose, you know, think of it as a matrix, be singular. That's not a square matrix. Okay? This has the Jacobian actually would have, if F is a mapping from Rn plus 1 in R, of course, then you have a matrix which has n plus 1 columns and n rows. In any case, this is sort of the basic idea of continuation of singularities, in this case, bifurcation points. And I don't want to dwell on that, but of course, for periodic solutions, X consists of a periodic orbit, a period, and this unfolding parameter in our case, or in dissipative system, some physical parameter. And the equation F of X represents the boundary value system for following periodic orbits. So that gets a bit more complicated, and you have to actually compute the adjoint, and you can believe that you get some messy equations that can be used for following these bifurcation points. That means computing what happens to these bifurcation points as mu changes. That is what you do. Okay? So this can also be set up as a boundary value problem. Again, this is a boundary value problem with periodic boundary conditions. And there, the x wiggle and v wiggle denote the adjoint variables. Actually, what you notice is, so this would be the representation of the restricted three-body equations in six-dimensional phase space, the positions and the velocities. And then these set of equations would be the adjoint equations. So basically, the size of your system doubles. That is not necessary. There are other ways to do that. You can also use minimally extended systems. There's quite a bit of numerical theory behind that goes back quite a long time. Wolfjürgen and Bein has worked on it. There's a book by Willy Hofart, and more recently, for the case of periodic orbits, as well as for conservative systems, we have been working with Yuri Kuznetsov and Willy Hofart on sort of the numerical foundation of this sort of calculation and show why it works and exactly how to do it using minimally extended systems. And also that has been implemented, not in Arto, but in some software called MatCont that uses MATLAB. Just a few results here. These are that is mu, the mass ratio. Before, I was looking at some small value of mu, like for the Earth-Moon system. You see there's only two intersecting points there. There, in fact, there are only two bifurcations, one for the halo orbits, one for the actual orbits. But you notice if mu is bigger, for example, if mu is 0.25, then you actually have three of such bifurcations from the Lyapunov family. And so we have this sort of diagram for all bifurcation points, and it gives us a complete overview of at least those bifurcations, and it also breaks the mu interval into sub-intervals, inside each of which the bifurcation diagrams, at least as far as we compute them, are topologically equivalent. So that is what we mean by classification here. In this case, for mu is 0.25, there's a red one here, a red one there, a red one there. These are bifurcation orbits. There are now three of them, right? And again, didn't I push the button? I thought I did. So here is the bifurcation diagram for a larger value of mu, where you can actually really see three bifurcations. So now this is sort of a family that you didn't see before. Also, what you note is that from this libration point, there are some families coming in with arrows, and that means they're actually homoclinic. Okay, they do not really connect to here in the sense of a Lyapunov type connection or a Hopf connection, if you wish. And in fact, there's only one family coming out, because what happens for small mu, there are three families coming out of L4 and L5. But two of the eigenvalues on the imaginary axis of the linearization coalesce, and then they split and get a real part. And so then only one family bifurcating from L4 and L5 is left. But there are homoclinics, and so here, for example, you see that there are three homoclinic families coming in that turn out to be homoclinic to L4 and similarly to L5 on the other side. And, wait until it appears. Another thing one can then do is to, so here, for example, is one of the homoclinic orbits passing close to the Earth, then zeroing in onto, well, let's call it L4, and going out again, and so on. This is one of the homoclinic orbits. Very interesting ones, by the way. And here is the, of course, you can also follow homoclinic orbits. That's very, very easy, in fact. And so I was looking at 0.25, and I was pointing out in my bifurcation diagram that there were three homoclinic orbits, which you can see. What happens if you decrease mu is that two of them start coming closer together and then annihilate each other. Then there's only one left, which finally stops at a particular value of mu 1, which appears to be exactly where, in the linearization, the two of the three purely imaginary eigenvalues come together and then split and become real. Exactly at the point where they come together seems to correspond exactly to that value of mu 1. So to end, I'll just show you a few of the homoclinic orbits along this. Notice actually one family, right? Okay. But I'll show you a few homoclinic orbits along here. In fact, I already showed you one, which was, I think, for a very large value of mu. I'll show you a few more as you approach this termination point here. And what actually happens is the following. Again, this is slow. So here again is the homoclinic orbit. So you wind into the libration point L4, and then you wind out and make a bit of a circle. This is for mu at 0.05. The termination point is somewhere around 0.038, I believe, where this family ends. And ending means that it becomes very, very difficult to compute any further. But the final value to which we get agrees to about four or five decimal places, will be known location of where the two coalesce, the eigenvalues, right? And that is known as the Hamiltonian-Hopf bifurcation. So you see it's a homoclinic to L4, winds out, and then winds back in again. Remember that all of this is taking place in six-dimensional phase space, or actually four-dimensional, because we're looking at planar orbits. Okay, and here is, now on an even smaller scale, the x and y velocity. Z is zero, they're planar. So you see the fixed point L4 would be here. They wind out very, very, very slowly. I mean, this is very dense, and then they go back in again. So really what it is a homoclinic orbit that is sitting in a box. The period is, of course, infinite, it being homoclinic, and it spirals in, it spirals out and spirals in, and the box in which it is located shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. It gets smaller and smaller, and as it gets smaller, and if you think of what is happening to the eigenvalues, it seems very reasonable, the spiraling gets denser and denser, okay, and then sort of in the limit, the box becomes a point, and this happens exactly at the Hamiltonian-Hopf bifurcation. Okay, so now it turns out that apparently this is appears to be known in work by Girardiot many quite a number of years ago, and it also appears that possibly there should be another homoclinic orbit emanating from this point. In any case, this is sort of one thing we found that fascinated us. This problem contains many more. Okay? This is going to be a rather long report, I believe, and possibly also one or two theses in my department. Thank you for your attention.